content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's spelled G. SUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. That's 919-875-8889. There's no new issue of Time yet today, since it's a federal holiday, the day that I'm reading, so I'm reverting to the issue dated September 21/September 28, 2020. This is the black and white cover rather than Time's usually red Time. It's now a gray superimposed Time on the cover. And the spelling of Time in gray is superimposed by all of the deaths that occurred during the COVID pandemic as of the publication of this issue. From the brief at the beginning of the magazine, the brief opener, Nation, after job losses, power cuts loom for millions. By Alana Samuels. After COVID-19 hit, Brandy Wilcoxon, a single mother in Atlanta, saw her weekly hours cut from 40 to around 13. Now, because she has to be home to supervise her two kids' virtual learning, she cannot pick up more shifts at her job as a security guard, so she struggles to cover rent and food, and she also owes about $1,000 in electric bills. When she contacted her power company about entering a payment plan, she says she was told she would need to pay $192 a month just to catch up, on top of whatever she will owe going forward. That's money Wilcoxon, 42, does not have. It would be robbing Peter to pay Paul, she says. The stakes for people in Wilcoxon's situation are about to get even higher. In September, after a pandemic-prompted pause, power companies serving tens of millions of Americans will resume service shutoffs to customers who are behind on their bills. In some states, moratoriums are ending, and others, utility companies' pledges to keep customers connected are winding down. We are facing a tidal wave of terminations, says Charlie Herrick, senior attorney for energy and utilities issues at the National Consumer Law Center. There is no national account of how many customers could lose power, but there are certainly millions who risk disconnection at a time when people need their utilities the most. Stuck at home, families are depending on their utilities to power the internet and lights for virtual school, and to keep on the air conditioning in areas facing sweltering heat. Carbon Switch, an energy efficiency startup, estimates 34.5 million people will lose shutoff protections in 14 states in the month of October. On the basis of data from Massachusetts, Herrick estimates as many as 10% of U.S. households are so far behind on bills they are at risk of termination when the moratoriums end. Duke Energy, which serves 7.8 million customers across seven states in the Southeast and Midwest, tells Time that as of August 30, roughly 300,000 of its customers were 60 days or more behind on gas or electric bills. In early August, Florida Power and Light Company said 258,000 customers were behind on payments. Tampa Electric Company said 92,000 of its customers were late. A public interest group said in June that 800,000 Pennsylvanians were at risk of service termination. Data filed with Minnesota's Public Utilities Commission shows more than 300,000 households in Minnesota were past due by the end of July. The threat of shutoffs is another sign of how measures to help Americans during the pandemic have fallen short. There were still 29 million Americans receiving unemployment benefits the week ending August 15, according to Commerce Department data. State unemployment offices slammed with a surge in applications and running on outdated systems are still trying to catch up. One in three families struggles to pay utility bills in normal times. More are falling behind because of the sudden loss of income. By October 1, only 14 states will have still prohibited power shutoffs, according to the Carbon Switch report. Utility companies defend their decisions to resume shutoffs, saying customers who know their power will not be cut stop trying to make payments. They've already lost billions of dollars from non-residential customers as a result of business closures. The American Public Power Association, which represents 2,000 public power utilities serving 49 million people, estimates that member revenues are down $5 billion in 2020. At some point, you do have to return to normal billing operations for business reasons, says Neil Nissan, a spokesman for Duke Energy. In August, Duke reported $1.1 billion in income for the 3 months ending June 30. With revenues down, many utility companies may try to raise rates on everyone, citing the threat posed by the coronavirus pandemic and volatility in capital markets. Appalachian Power in Virginia has asked regulators to let it raise rates 6.5%. The request has not yet been approved. The Virginia Attorney General's office said in a filing it would be unconscionable to approve. Indiana's utility regulatory agency approved Duke Energy's request for a rate increase in June. Rate hikes would be especially hard on low-income families who devote three times as much of their income to energy costs as higher-income households. While some states are continuing to prevent shutoffs, regulators in Wisconsin, Maryland, and Massachusetts extended their moratoriums, for example. Consumer advocates have urged Congress to impose a national moratorium on utility shutoffs. They have cited health concerns if people affected by cutoffs move in with friends or family members, increasing the risk of transmitting the coronavirus. But the mounting shutoffs have already forced Americans struggling to pay bills to consider something that seemed unthinkable a year ago. Life without basic services like electricity or water. Tanya Berry, 36, who lives near Philadelphia, experienced this when her water was shut off in August after she fell behind on payments following a pandemic-related job loss. She could not mix formula for her baby or give her children baths. You don't realize how much you need it, she says, until you don't have it. From the bulletin, no place to go is the caption of a photograph here. It looks like a murky day, a foggy day, a gray day. Everything in the background is in blacks and grays. But there are two women in the foreground of this photo, and they are in colorful garb. One is wearing a black and white striped dress with pink tights or leggings and pink shoes and a bright reddish pink scarf. And the person in the complete foreground is dressed in blue. She has a blue, I believe it's called a hijab, on her head and across her face as if she were wearing a mask. and she's carrying bundles of items. One looks like a red blanket stuffed into a transparent plastic bag, and the other is an opaque bag in black and tan. I don't know if it's a wardrobe container. And then she has another purse or small bag slung across her shoulder. She's looking at what looks like a pile of ashen debris. It again is in the foreground with her, and it matches the background, the colors of grays and blacks. A migrant woman surveys the wreckage after a fire destroyed the Moria or Moriah refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos, the largest such facility in Europe. September 9. Aid workers have long condemned the poor conditions in the camp, which was built for 3,000 people but housed more than 12,000, who have now been left homeless. Greek authorities allege the blaze was started by residents angry over a COVID-19 quarantine imposed on the camp earlier in the week. Again, this is the bulletin. After poisoning, Germany threatens $11.2 billion pipeline with Russia. The future of a 765-mile pipeline being built to carry gas directly to Germany from Russia is now in question, as Berlin ramps up pressure on Moscow to investigate the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The Nord Stream 2 project would help Europe ensure a constant supply of natural gas as domestic production is expected to drop. But German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas warned September 6 the country might change its stance on the $11.2 billion pipeline if Russia fails to cooperate in looking into an attack for which Moscow has denied responsibility. Pipe Dreams, owned by the Russian state-controlled energy giant Gazprom, Nord Stream 2 is 94% complete and due to open in early 2021. Some European countries and the U.S. oppose it, fearing it could become a tool of political leverage for the Kremlin. But German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been adamant that the pipeline go ahead, saying political considerations should be separate from business decisions. Since Berlin detected Novichok, an internationally banned nerve agent, in Navalny's body September 2, pressure has mounted on the chancellor to scrap the pipeline. Navalny emerged from his medically induced coma September 7 and has shown signs of recovery. Norbert Röttgen, a lawmaker in Merkel's CDU party, said, "We must respond with the only language Russian President Vladimir Putin understands, that is, gas sales." Merkel's chief spokesperson said September 7, "It's too early to determine how Germany will respond." The international response to previous Russian transgressions has not made much of an impact, analysts say. But halting Nord Stream 2 would be a huge setback for Russia, says Nigel Gould Davies, a senior fellow at UK-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. Doing nothing, on the other hand, will show a lack of resolve and will likely encourage Russia to probe and test its limits in the future. The bulletin was written by Madeline Roach. Here are three very short news ticker items. Judge halts census rollbacks. In a September 5 restraining order, a federal judge in California instructed the Census Bureau to temporarily stop winding down in-person counting for the 2020 population tally. Plaintiffs are suing to stop the Bureau's plan to cut the count short by a month from its original October 31 end date. Duterte pardons U.S. Marine. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte pardoned a U.S. Marine September 7 in a surprise move swiftly condemned by human rights groups. Lance Corporal Joseph Scott Pemberton was convicted of homicide in the 2014 killing of transgender Filipino woman Jennifer Loud in a motel northwest of the capital, Manila. COVID-19 spike linked to biker rally. A San Diego State University study linked August's 10-day Sturgis motorcycle rally in South Dakota to more than a quarter million COVID-19 cases and about $12.2 billion in public health costs. The event attracted nearly 500,000 people, many of whom packed into bars and restaurants without face coverings. The brief news, good question, how many young people, young adults moved home amid the pandemic, by Tara Law. This year, millions of young adults have retreated to familiar territory, living at home with mom and dad. About 2.6 million 18 to 29-year-old Americans started living with at least one of their parents since February, bringing the total to 26.6 million in July, or about 52% of all young adults in the country, according to a Pew Research Center analysis released September 4 of Census Bureau data. This number shattered the previous record of 48% set during the Great Depression. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the trend is inextricably linked to the COVID-19 pandemic, but that is not the whole story. Among that wave of Americans moving back home was Mika Vanskoyuk, S-C-O-Y-O-C, a 27-year-old ad copywriter. While she loved living in New York City, she also had credit card debt and limited savings, and once the pandemic closed offices, she did not want to work from home with a roommate in a small apartment. Now living with her parents in the suburbs of North Carolina, she feels lucky to be close to family and to have fresh air and open space. My room is comparable to my entire apartment in New York, she says. But Vanskoyuk is also following a trend that began well before the novel coronavirus struck. The number of young adults living with their parents rose from a low of 29% in 1960 to 44% in 2010 as Americans stayed in school longer and put off milestones like getting married. However, this year's increase is notably sharp and tracks with the pandemic's timing. While 46 or 47% of Americans in that age group lived with a parent through 2019, the number jumped to 49% in March, then to 52% from May through July. In 88% of those situations, the young adult lives in the parent's house. Young adults were also the age group most likely to move as a result of the outbreak, with 9% moving because of COVID-19, compared with 3% for the overall population, according to Pew polling in June. Though people of all ages hit the road for virus-related reasons, among all adults who moved because of the pandemic, 28% said they did so to avoid its spread, 23% because their college campus closed, and 20% to be closer to family. Money also seems to have played a big part in young people's decisions, as young Americans have shouldered some of the worst financial impacts of the pandemic. In April and May, 40% of workers ages 18 to 29 reported they've lost their jobs or taken pay cuts. According to the June poll, about 18% of all adults who moved because of COVID-19 said the biggest reason was related to money or losing their jobs. Vanskoyuk has been able to keep working, but given the unpredictability of the pandemic, she is still not sure when she'll move out of her parents' house. It does seem like it's not really worthwhile to try to make plans in the face of this, just because there's so much that's so uncertain, she says. I am just kind of taking it as it comes. More news tickers. Three more short items. DOJ seeks to defend Trump in Carroll suit. The Justice Department asked September 8 to take over President Trump's defense in a defamation suit by writer E. Jean Carroll, who claimed he raped her in the 1990s. The DOJ argues it should be involved because Trump was acting as president when denying Carroll's charge. Tensions rise at China-India border. China and India accused each other's troops of firing shots September 7 at their disputed Himalayan border. Indo-Chinese relations have deteriorated in recent months. The alleged violations of a bilateral agreement, which both sides deny, would mark the first confirmed shots fired at the border since 1975. Police chief in Rochester out after protests. The Rochester, New York police chief and other top department officials stepped down September 8 following protests over the treatment of Daniel Prude, who died in March after police covered Prude's head and held him down. The chief, LaRon Singletary, accused outside groups of trying to destroy my character. Under design, more than one-hit wonders. There's a photograph here of a mannequin's head. It is without a wig, and it's wearing a mask. The mask is transparent. It covers the face and nose. It has what look like two mesh, perhaps respirator filters or respiratory filters on either side of the mouth, and it seems to be held in place also by a transparent or translucent band. Mask crusade. Amid COVID-19 supply shortages, researchers at MIT and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston designed a sterilizable mask for health workers made of silicone rubber that can stop viral particles. Having a blast, fireworks are fun, but they also produce trash and emit pollutants. An alternative called RamMax uses LED lights and reusable rockets to create sustainable light shows more than 300 feet high. Wash and go. Yes, reusable cloth toilet paper exists and has for years. Its proponents see it as eco-friendly and cost-effective. Health experts, however, caution that using it safely requires taking special precautions with your laundry. Most spacecraft are made for one-time use, but on September 6, China successfully recovered a reusable one after it spent 2 days in orbit. And that little column was written by Melissa Godin. The brief postcard, a photo here of quite a large assembly of people under some leafy trees. I'm able to count about a dozen. It looks like most or all are wearing masks. There are a couple of children in the foreground. They look fairly young, maybe 6 and 7 or 5 and 6, and they too are wearing masks. There are some adults behind them. The caption reads, after school, September 2 in Wuhan, where life's normal rhythms have resumed. The brief postcard features, Wuhan strives to return to normal, but coronavirus scars run deep, by Charlie Campbell, Wuhan, China. Every year on August 25, China celebrates the Qixi Festival, that's spelled Q-I-X-I, the nation's equivalent of Valentine's Day. Rooted in a mythical romance between an ox herd and a weaver girl, it is when romance blooms and gooey-eyed sweethearts exchange overpriced trinkets. In the central city of Wuhan, where the COVID-19 pandemic first emerged in December, couples relished this year's festivities more than most. Ding Hui, 33, contracted the virus in mid-January and only survived after being intubated in an intensive care unit. Now fully recovered, Ding threw a party to celebrate Qixi with friends in a penthouse overlooking the Han River. Hearts were painted on the windows. Black, white, and gold balloons added a touch of glamour, plus entertainment for her son, Niu, 7. Her sickness lent perspective to her own romantic situation. In the past, I wanted to divorce my husband every time we quarreled, says Ding. But after I was discharged from the hospital, I told my husband that I would never mention divorce again. The coronavirus pandemic continues to rage across every continent, with more than 25 million cases reported globally. On September 7, India set a world record for daily infections with 90,802 new cases, yet China reported just 12 the same day, all imported. Here the pandemic feels like old news. When this reporter was last in Wuhan in January, it was just hours before authorities enforced a draconian 76-day lockdown, and the streets were already desolate. When I returned in August, my cab driver didn't even wear a face mask. Traffic was either snarled or terrifyingly fast. And love was in the air. At Fatty Fatty Crawfish Restaurant, couples gazed into each other's eyes over steaming piles of desiccated crustacean shells, crimson grease dripping from gloved hands onto plastic tablecloths. Outside, young lovers crammed into karaoke booths and browsed jewelry at teeming night markets, grateful to plan for the future once again. Yet Wuhan remains a nervy, contradictory place, desperate to banish bad memories that it cannot afford to forget. At her party, between joshing with friends from behind comical pink sunglasses, Ding makes sure to spray the takeaway food containers with sterilizing ethanol. In the building's lobby, a vending machine sponsored by U.S. conglomerate 3M sells masks, hand sanitizer, and other plague sundries. The economy is still suffering. The latest data from May suggests factory output, retail sales, and exports in Wuhan are a long way from returning to normal, while many shops and businesses have closed for good. Wuhan is a badly injured child, still slowly recovering, says Ding. Wuhan's recovery has become a propaganda tussle. While President Trump has described the pandemic as the Wuhan virus, Chinese officials have seized on the city's resurgence as vindication of the country's autocratic political system. When photographs of thousands of young people crammed into a pool party rave in Wuhan went viral in mid-August, many in the U.S. criticized their revelry as insensitive, given the spiraling death toll elsewhere. But China's jingoistic state media were unrepentant, brushing off objections as sour grapes. Only time will tell whether there will be more trouble ahead. The source of the outbreak still has not been established, though the working hypothesis is that it leaped from an unknown animal to a human, connected to Wuhan's Huanan seafood market, which was known to stock various exotic species. That market remains closed today, but throughout the city, time saw street-side stalls selling butchered meat alongside live crayfish, eels, and huge pulsing bullfrogs. The fear is that confidence bleeds into complacency. China is very strong, Ding says. I'm grateful that I have been in China during the pandemic. Had I caught the virus in a different country, I probably would not be alive today. 76 consecutive days Wuhan was locked down from January 23. The brief time. As America approaches raw truths about race, Claudia Rankine is ready to guide us, by Andrew R. Chow. And Rankine's last name is spelled R-A-N-K-I-N-E. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing it correctly, for which I apologize if I'm not. The author and poet Claudia Rankine witnessed the collective muted response after James Byrd Jr. was dragged to death along an asphalt road in Texas in 1998. She watched widespread resistance rise against the nascent Black Lives Matter movement in 2013 and 2014 following the murder of Trayvon Martin. Whenever she wrote books or essays about white privilege or racism, she expected to receive waves of denial or personal attacks because she knew how white people deny white privilege and black death. So she was surprised when in late May white people stormed the streets alongside people of color across the world to protest racial violence and injustice following the murder of George Floyd. "That was the most hope I've felt in a long time," Rankine says in a phone interview. "I think we are suddenly seeing the same reality." Rankine's life's work has been driven by getting people to understand these grim realities. In searing works like Don't Let Me Be Lonely and Citizen, which was a National Book Award finalist, she has explored how anti-black racism has manifested in ways both mundane and tragic. For many years, it seemed as if Rankine was screaming into the void, laying bare a version of America that many people refused to accept. But Just Us, her new work of poetry, personal essays, and historical documents, arrives into a changed climate in which many people are finally coming to grips with uncomfortable truths. Still, Rankine argues in the book that Americans have a long way to go toward understanding how deeply anti-black racism is embedded into nearly every aspect of our society, from corporate culture to classrooms to even hair color. It is really a moment for us to slow down and understand that a white supremacist orientation has determined almost everything in the country, Rankine says. For us to reroute, we have to ask more questions and really be uncomfortable. Rankine was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and immigrated at the age of 7 with her parents to the Bronx, where she says racism was palpable but mostly latent. While Rankine was an acclaimed poet in the early 90s, her work took on increased urgency and focus after she learned of Byrd's lynching. "I just thought, who are these people we live among?" she says. "I first met her on a frigid day back in February when the world was buzzing about as usual, and she was preparing for the premiere of her play Help at the Shed in Manhattan, which portrays fraught encounters with white men around the world. While I had many lofty questions prepared for her, Rankine initially just wanted to talk about my hair. I had recently dyed it bleach blonde, inspired by Frank Ocean, BTS's RM, and an unholy mixture of curiosity and boredom. Rankine, smirking slightly, took pictures of my desiccated strands, saying she had written an essay about whether people consider blondness in terms of whiteness. I was startled by the sentence and, frankly, a little defensive. What did my dyeing my hair on a whim and inspired by artists of color have to do with whiteness or reinforcing racist systems? I did not press the issue, and any chance for a follow-up conversation evaporated when COVID-19 quickly began spreading across the U.S. Help closed after 2 previews. Rankine went back home to New Haven, Connecticut, where she's professor of poetry at Yale. She was staying at home. A previous bout with cancer made her a higher risk for severe illness from COVID-19, when in May, new videos showing threats or violence against black people began to spread across the internet. These videos were grief-inducing to Rankine. "For all of these deaths, you feel the same depth of devastation," she says. But she also recognized that they revealed to a captive world the array of indignities and dangers that black people can face on a daily basis. The Amy Cooper video was, to me, a real gift to society, with her performance of fear, her uses of civility, she says. I hope it gets taught in classes. This kind of white woman who weaponizes her fear in an attempt to have black people murdered, we have seen it again and again. Over the next few months, Rankine watched in amazement as rhetoric about whiteness and racism that might have previously been perceived as radical now began to receive support in mainstream discourse. She celebrated as books about racism and anti-racism, from Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility to Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist, surged to the top of the bestseller lists. White men and women are beginning to have a shared understanding and a shared vocabulary for what's going on, she says. I do not feel like I'm starting at the beginning of these conversations. Despite this progress, however, Rankine knows the country still has miles to go in terms of fully confronting its racist past, especially with a current leadership that often defends white supremacists. For some people, it is a PR moment, she says. We will see whether people will follow up this initial response with more sustained inquiries and modes of shifting within their own organizations, corporations, and institutions. Rankine hopes that Just Us will encourage readers to have these deeper and more difficult conversations. While she finished the book before the current moment of unrest, its themes have made it prescient. I feel as if the book's addressing everything that lives below that, she says, of the pandemic and protests. The circumstances that Just Us addresses have not changed. The book includes uncomfortable vignettes from dinner parties, racist writings from Thomas Jefferson, data elucidating the wealth gap between black and white families. It shows how anti-black racism haunts preschools, college campuses, police precincts, and everywhere in between. But the part of the book that struck me most was the essay on blondness that Rankine had mentioned months back. In it, she traces the preference for blondness from Italian Renaissance writers through Nazi Germany through to the Trump family. She points out that many of the most famous blondes, from Marilyn Monroe to Princess Diana, were not actually natural blondes, but were just following beauty standards. If white supremacy and anti-black racism remain fundamental structural modes of violence by which countries continue to govern, Rankine writes, blondness might be one of our most passive and fluid modes of complicity. It points to white power and its values as desirable, whether the thought enters one's head or not. Reading the chapter, My Pitch Black Roots, having once again assumed control of my scalp, I felt a gut punch. So many seemingly trivial matters are tied to centuries of oppression, and all of us are, as individuals, are complicit in many of those systems. But for Rankine, the point is not so-called cancellation, but interrogation and growth. When I mention my shame to her, she laughs it off, and then widens the scope of the conversation. Do whatever you want, she says, but one of the things I'm trying to say in Just Us is there's a history behind all of our decisions, and we should make them with the full consciousness of what that history is. There's a photo here of Claudia Rankine, and she's saying that was the most hope I've had in a long time. She's sitting on a polished wooden bench and leaning against a backrest. The wooden bench is in the tones of brown. The backrest is in white. It looks like it's padding along a wooden beam. And there's also an off-white backdrop behind her in this portrait. She's wearing black and white striped pants and a colorful black and gold and green long-sleeved shirt. She's wearing a long strand of black beads. She's looking right into the camera with her brown eyes, and her lips are somewhat rouged, and her hair is fluffy and gray. Lightbox Education. College is open, but life is shut down, by Katie Riley, with reporting by Paul Moakley, New York. There's a photo here of a co-ed sitting on the lawn in front of a great and grand brick building with a portico and many columns and a steeple and a grand staircase to the main doorways. The co-ed is dressed in jeans cutoffs. It looks like white tennis shoes, an off-white shirt, and she is wearing a mask over her nose and mouth. She has long brown hair. She's looking at the camera and holding a pen or pencil and it might be a stylus, and she has a little electronic device on her lap, personal electronic device. Education. College is open, but life is shut down. The typically bustling main campus of Pennsylvania State University is quieter than normal. Many students are tuning into classes online from their dorm rooms. A town ban on gatherings of more than 10 people limits social life off campus. Mask requirements make recognizing faces and making friends more challenging. I can tell the university is trying their best to give returning and new students the full experience that Penn State has the potential to bring, says Sophia Melochi, 20, a junior. It is just not the same. Across the country, colleges have taken a range of approaches to the fall semester. A Chronicle of Higher Education tracker of nearly 3,000 colleges found that of those with firm plans, 19% are opening primarily in person, 27% are primarily online, and 16% are, like Penn State, a mix. But all are facing a semester unlike any other. Schools that brought students back to campus quickly have run into problems controlling their behavior. Some have criticized universities for shifting blame for coronavirus outbreaks onto the returning students. Penn State recently suspended a fraternity that threw a party with about 70 people, and it reprimanded other students for gathering without masks and close together in large crowds outside a residence hall. I ask students flouting the university's health and safety expectations a simple question. Do you want to be the person responsible for sending everyone home? Penn State President Eric Barron said in a statement. As of September 4, more than 200 students at Penn State's University Park campus had tested positive for COVID-19 since August 21. And Barron said that trend could force a shift to fully online classes. That's already happened at other colleges. Several clusters of coronavirus cases in dorms at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill led the school to cancel in-person classes and move to a fully remote model August 19, a week after classes began. At the University of Alabama's Tuscaloosa campus, more than 1,800 students tested positive for COVID-19 since returning to school. The 40,000 undergraduates at Penn State's University Park campus are hoping their institution does better. I originally thought we would be sent home or moved completely online within the first 2 weeks of school, but we'll see how it goes, because it seems like the school has it under control, says C.J. Scofoni, a 20, a junior. I hope it gets better and goes back to normal. Under politics, homegrown threat. Misinformation about voting has eroded Americans' faith in a fair election, by Vera Bergengruen and Lisandra Villa. After months of watching commenters flood his office's social media posts with voting myths and fielding calls about election conspiracies from constituents, Brian Corley finally got fed up. In July, the supervisor of elections in Florida's Pasco County decided to shut down his office's Facebook and Twitter accounts to stop false claims from spreading. "I just got tired of the misinformation and the partisan bickering back and forth," says Corley, a Republican with 13 years on the job. "I saw no value in it as an election administrator. If 2016 showed how foreign operatives were exploiting social media to influence the U.S. election, the lesson of 2020 is already clear and even more worrisome. The greatest threat to a credible vote is homegrown. From the White House on down, Americans have taken a page from the Kremlin's playbook by weaponizing misinformation online to advance their political goals. Election officials like Corley are struggling to break through an avalanche of falsehoods about mail-in ballots, doubts about the integrity of voting systems, and skepticism about the validity of the results. No one has done more to sow suspicion or spread lies than President Donald Trump, whose aggressive attacks on mail-in voting and false allegations of widespread voter fraud have capitalized on fear and uncertainty about holding a presidential election in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. On television, at rallies, and on Twitter, Trump has falsely claimed that mail-in ballots lead to massive corruption and fraud, that foreign powers will forge ballots, that the only way we're going to lose this election is if the election's rigged. He has falsely implied ballots are being sent to undocumented immigrants in California, and even suggested delaying the election, which he has no authority to do, until Americans can safely vote in person. None of this is new exactly. As a candidate in 2016, Trump pushed baseless claims of voter fraud, including that hordes of dead people and non-citizens would vote for Democrats. Now, with the weight of the most powerful office in the world, his allegations are being parroted by federal and state officials, GOP activists, local campaigns, small-town radio shows, and national media outlets. Vice President Mike Pence has backed up his unfounded claims, and Attorney General William Barr has alleged that mail voting opens the floodgates to fraud. Election administrators from both parties, as well as nonpartisan officials in Trump's own government, insist voting by mail is safe. The FBI says it's found no evidence of coordinated fraud with mail-in ballots, and emphasize such a scenario would be very unlikely. It would be extraordinarily difficult to change a federal election outcome through this type of fraud alone, a senior FBI official told reporters in an August 26 briefing. But a claim does not have to be true to affect an election. U.S. national security agencies and social media companies, which spent the last 4 years working to weed out false claims perpetuated by foreign adversaries, say the domestic disinformation this year presents a new challenge. Because of the constitutional right to free speech, it can be nearly impossible to police bad faith claims, whether the speaker's an internet troll or the commander-in-chief. The result threatens not only the perceived legitimacy of this election, but also Americans' broader faith in U.S. democracy. We have already seen that the president's rhetoric is affecting the confidence that voters have in vote-by-mail particularly, and also in elections in general, Sylvia Albert, director of voting and elections at Common Cause, testified to Congress August 4. Gallup found last year 59% of Americans are not confident in the honesty of the nation's elections, third worst among the world's wealthy democracies. While Trump and his allies have propagated misinformation about voting, the Gallup poll found Trump's critics are most distrustful. 74% of those opposed to the U.S. leadership reported a lack of confidence in the honesty of American elections. The Trump administration's attacks on the Postal Service exacerbated the problem, raising the question of whether the agency's capable of delivering ballots before state deadlines. Even as officials scramble to fight back by explaining that voting by mail is secure, they worry about the stakes for the nation. The prospect of misinformation drowning out credible facts and eroding voters' faith in elections keeps me up at night, says Corley, the Pasco County Republican. It is tough to put the genie back in the bottle. There is a photo here of Brian Corley, a bald-headed individual with a neat, trim beard, wearing a blue shirt and tan slacks, standing in front of a blue background, perhaps in his office of elections in Pasco County, Florida. He has both the U.S. flag and the Florida state flag at his right. The threat is an order of magnitude greater now than 4 years ago. In 2016, a hostile foreign adversary tried to sway Americans to vote for one candidate over another. This year, the candidate is calling into question the integrity of the vote itself. Trump's fear-mongering about the need to fight voter fraud has given new life to decades-old tactics like voter roll purges, stringent voter ID laws, poll watchers who try to intimidate people from casting ballots, and other measures that reduce turnout. 2016 was the fake news election, but 2020 makes it look like nothing in comparison, says Samuel Woolley, Project Director for Propaganda Research at the Center for Media Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. This infrastructure that's been scaled up since politicians started figuring out social media has now become concretized under Donald Trump down to the state level, the city level. It is the democratization of propaganda. Last month, former Nevada Republican Senator Dean Heller claimed without evidence that a new state law which would send every registered voter a ballot in the mail would allow Nevadans to vote twice. They are going to allow anonymous people to walk into any home, any facility, to help you fill out your ballot and take it with them, Heller said, echoing arguments made by the Trump campaign in a suit seeking to block the law. Heller's claims were repeated in television interviews and widely shared on social media, even as the state's Republican Secretary of State, Barbara Chegovsky, tried to reassure voters such claims were not true. Trump's rhetoric has also been adopted by Republican candidates. Election fraud should concern each and every voter in this country, wrote Margaret Stryker, a Republican running in Connecticut's 3rd Congressional District, in a post shared more than 100 times on Facebook. Nicole Malliotakis, a Republican running in New York, took it up a notch, paying for Facebook ads claiming she had stopped the Liberal Democrats' plan to automatically register illegal aliens to vote in our elections. The purpose of such claims is hardly subtle. In early April, Georgia State Speaker of the House, David Ralston, said the quiet part out loud when he argued that if the state allows mail-in ballots, it will be extremely devastating to Republicans and conservatives because it will certainly drive up turnout. This combination of disinformation, uncertainty, and valid concerns over the logistics of holding an election during a pandemic also has many Democrats on edge. The Trump administration is a corrupt administration, Bertilda Dufresne said August 28 at a racial justice protest on the anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington. I see what they're doing with the post office and voter suppression, so I'm concerned they will cheat, they will steal, they will lie to keep this man in power. These fears were worsened by Trump's recent promise to send law enforcement to the polls to monitor for voter fraud. We're going to have sheriffs. We're going to have law enforcement. We're going to have, hopefully, U.S. attorneys, Trump said on Fox News August 20. The president has no control over local law enforcement, yet the mere threat could depress turnout if voters believe it. Voter fraud's exceedingly rare in the U.S., according to a 2017 Brennan Center for Justice review of more than a dozen studies. A Trump-appointed commission disbanded in 2018 after it was unable to find evidence of widespread voter fraud. The truth is that after decades of looking for illegal voting, there's no proof of widespread fraud. At most, there are isolated incidents by both Democrats and Republicans, veteran GOP election lawyer Benjamin Ginsburg wrote in the Washington Post, September 8. Yet Trump's claims have found a willing audience in his party. The GOP has long promoted the idea that fraud is ubiquitous in order to support legal efforts to restrict ballot access, which disproportionately affect voters of color who tend to vote Democratic, and to justify a need for close election monitoring. While both parties regularly use poll watchers, this year will mark the first presidential election in decades in which Republicans will have the freedom to pursue their poll monitoring plans without prior approval from a court, after a federal consent decree that limited the Republican National Committee's operations ended 2 years ago. The consent decree had its roots in voter intimidation. Ultimately, whether Americans believe November's election to be free, fair, and valid is being challenged by one of the two men on the ballot. 4 years ago, Russia subverted American democracy with a campaign to elect Donald Trump. This year, the Kremlin's taking its cues from him. On September 3, DHS issued an intelligence bulletin warning. Russia's once again seeking to undermine faith in the U.S. electoral process. Among its methods, amplifying criticisms of the integrity of expanded and universal vote-by-mail, claiming ineligible voters could receive ballots due to out-of-date voter rolls, leaving a vast amount of ballots vulnerable to tampering. Not much question where the Kremlin came up with that. The previous article was slightly abridged. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.